Welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza on this pre-recorded program, via remote. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, August 4th, 2021. The head of the United States Agency for International Development pledges support to Sudan's transitional government of national unity.
We are looking together, of course, not only at how to deal with the pandemic in the here and now, but how to support Sudan's own efforts to strengthen its health system.
And media associations in South Sudan demand inclusion in the country's constitution-making process.
The media is said to be the fourth estate of the realm. In this regard, we wish to highlight the critical role of the media in the permanent constitution-making process.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The head of the United States Agency for International Development says the U.S. is committed to deepening its engagement and partnership with the people of Sudan. For VOA News, Michael Atit reports from Khartoum.
At the end of the four-day visit to Sudan yesterday, U.S. Aid Chief Samantha Power pledged $56 million to provide emergency health care, nutrition, water and sanitation, and hygiene programs in Sudan. Power says U.S. Aid is also helping Sudan fight the spread of COVID-19 by donating some 600,000 doses of Johnson & Johnson vaccine, which are expected to be shipped to Khartoum tomorrow.
We are looking together, of course, not only at how to deal with the pandemic in the here and now, but how to support Sudan's own efforts to strengthen its health system. And that's true, yes, of course, in internally displaced persons camps where there are still such gaping holes when it comes to maternal health, a shortage of ambulances, I mean, very, very basic needs not being met, but the health system as a whole.
Sudan received more than 50,000 Ethiopian refugees since the Tigray conflict broke out in November 2020. The U.S. aid chief visited eastern Sudan, which hosts tens of thousands of Ethiopian refugees, as well as the troubled western region of Darfur. The United States is the single largest humanitarian donor to Sudan, providing nearly $377 million since the beginning of the fiscal year. Power says this funding will help the Sudanese people cope up with conflict, food insecurity, the economic crisis, and cycle of drought and flooding. She says the United States will continue to stand with the people of Sudan as they deal with a compounding crisis, including the deteriorating economy.
With rising inflation and recent subsidy cuts, of course, everywhere I have traveled, you know, I have been able to see the hope and the sense of possibility, but also the impatience and the frustration, because so far the economic dividend on the revolution has not been felt by most Sudanese.
Power says USAID is committed to supporting the transitional government, political parties, civil society, and media to work towards a peaceful and credible election process at the end of Sudan's transitional period in 2024.
2024 can feel like a long way off. There's so much that can happen between now and then. But you can. It is never too soon to begin preparing for an election. So USAID will also contribute more than $4 million to support electoral processes and an independent election commission.
The U.S. official says her country will actively support civilian-led security reform and the formal integration of the paramilitary group Rapid Support Forces and former opposition armed groups into one unified army. She says the U.S. government will always stand with any peaceful and democratic governance in Sudan.
Sudan's future challenges are daunting, including the consolidation of the army and former armed opposition groups under a single unified command. But the potential that Sudan has with all of its natural wealth and its human capital, that potential is enormous. And the United States, again, is committed to helping support Sudan's peaceful and civilian-led transition.
Sudanese Prime Minister Abdalla Hamdok expressed the gratitude of his government to the U.S. aid support. He says Sudan is also committed to strengthen its relations with the U.S. government. After meeting with officials in Khartoum, Power headed to Addis Ababa for talks with Ethiopian officials on humanitarian access to the Tigray region. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum.
From Khartoum, we move to Juba, where South Sudanese media advocacy groups are calling for the inclusion of media stakeholders in the country's permanent constitution-making process. A coalition of nine media organizations led by the Union of Journalists of South Sudan says the media has been left out of all key national processes, yet it plays a pivotal role in civic education and mobilization of the people in the country. For VOA News, Wake Simon Wudu reports from Juba.
The Association for Media Development in South Sudan, the Community Media Network of South Sudan, the Female Journalist Network, and other media groups say parties leading the permanent constitution-making process need to recognize the media as a core stakeholder in the process. The coalition is demanding inclusion of media representatives as members in the constitution-making process, as well as recognition of being observers at the legislative process. Speaking at a joint press briefing in Juba today, Patrick Oyet, chairperson of the Union of Journalists of South Sudan, says this time the media not only wants to report on the constitution-making process, but to be part of it.
We recollect that the constitution-making process in South Sudan, including the 2005 interim constitution and the transitional constitution of South Sudan 2011 as amended, were made with limited or no public participation. The media is said to be the fourth estate of the realm. In this regard, we wish to highlight the critical role of the media in the permanent constitution-making process in line with the letter and spirit of Chapter 6 of the agreement in order to ensure legitimacy based on ownership through inclusive participation of South Sudanese people.
The permanent constitutional-making process is mandated by the peace agreement. Oyet says making the permanent constitution is a critical element of the governance reforms stipulated in the deal, and all stakeholders, including the media, should be involved in making decisions during the process.
We are, however, concerned that the critical role of the media in peace-building processes, including the permanent constitution-making process, has not been recognized and made, and media practitioners have not been accorded the necessary participatory inclusion by the parties to the peace agreement in particular and the leadership of the country in general.
Oyet says despite the work of journalists during negotiations which led to the signing of the peace deal in 2018, there has been no recognition of the important role the media has played in South Sudan, including its reporting on the implementation of the peace deal.
For example, in the R-Axis 2018, there is no specific provision that highlights and recognizes the media as one of the drivers for development and peace building, democracy building in the country. During the R-Axis 2018 negotiation, media did the coverage, while the civil society, women, eminent personalities, and faith-based groups were all represented at the peace process as stakeholders, which enabled them to participate jointly, that gave birth to the pact.
President Salva Kiir launched the permanent constitution-making process in May as required by the peace deal. The process was facilitated by the Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, or RJMEC. Article 6, subsection 13 of the peace deal states that the process of the permanent constitution-making shall be led and owned by the people of South Sudan. Again, Oyet Patrick.
The media plays a key role in civic education and will play an important role in mobilizing South Sudanese people to effectively participate in the permanent constitution-making process. Consequently, we call upon all parties and other stakeholders in the pact to give consideration to including media practitioners in the permanent constitution-making process.
South Sudan's security service operatives stomped into today's news conference, while representatives of media houses and media advocacy groups were taking questions from journalists. The security agents ordered Oyet and some of his colleagues to report to the South Sudan Media Authority office. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
A unique football tournament in South Sudan is casting a gleam of hope for visually impaired teenagers. A coach of the 12-member South Sudan squad for the blind says the matches between visually impaired teams aim to create an inclusive opportunity for sports in the country. For VOA News, Sheila Pony reports from Juba.
A team of visually impaired teens gathered at the Dr. Biaro Sports Complex in the heart of Juba over the weekend for the first ever blind football tournament. It was the second match organized by the South Sudan Blind Football Association with support from the Australian-based Light for the World, an international disability and development organization. The 12-member South Sudan blind sportsperson squad arrived in their cribs, green and white jersey, ready for the competition on Saturday. Simon Madol Akol is the coach of the blind sportsperson squad.
You see, people with disabilities are left behind in a lot of things. And one of them is education and sport. So in sport, you see, we were having fun, CAI. People were surprised. They were seeing us playing. They never knew that person who are blind can play football. It was strange. And I believe everything that a person without disability can do, a person with disability can do.
Charles Pasquale Clement is chairperson of the South Sudan Blind Football Association and a midfielder on the team.
So people are asking us questions. The ball that you're playing, is it the same with the one the sight people are playing, or yours is different? And then we said, no, it is the same, but the difference is the ball that we are playing, it has got a bell inside.
The specially designed footballs help visually impaired players move the ball around the pitch and toward the goal. The special footballs, sighted goalkeepers, and guides on the field all help the 5-member teams move the ball into scoring positions. Coach Akol explains how the bowlers are able to dribble and pass the ball.
We have a word called boy. This word called boy, we use it when you are attacking, because if you don't say boy, you may hit each other. So you say boy, so the person with the ball can know there's somebody coming to attack. We have guides. You see, goalkeeper also acts as a guide, because goalkeeper is always sighted. And behind the goal, there's also a guide. Behind the other goal, there's also a guide. And goalkeeper on the other side is also a guide. And then the coaches. You see, the field is also divided into three. The side of the defenders, where defenders are in, it is guided by the goalkeeper. And the people who are coming to attack are guided by the guide that's standing behind the goal. So that's how we play.
The match lasted 60 minutes as players dribbled and scored goals, to the delight of fans who came to cheer on their players. South Sudan Blind Football Association Chief Clement, who is also a player, scored 3 goals in the match.
I feel very, very exciting. The most very important thing is to keep your position, the position where you play, and not the direction of where the goal is. By keeping that in your mind, you could be able to run with the ball very fast, and then also for you to pass the ball to your friend and to know the direction where your opponent is coming to attack you.
Beyond sportsmanship, the tournament helps train players and coaches and raise awareness among the general population.
We have a plan whereby in nearest time to come, we need to introduce more and then expand to the other states within South Sudan, so that some of our friends, some of our brothers and sisters on the other state, they could be able to join us and enjoy the full fundamental rights in aspect of human life.
With additional funding, the South Sudan Blind Football Association says it hopes to hold 2 more matches in the coming month. For VOA News, I am Sheila Oponi in Juba.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. Coming up, a Sudanese activist says human trafficking is a problem in North Africa. That story is coming up right after the break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what is the best advice you have ever gotten?
I got an advice from my mom. She encouraged me to work hard. That she told me, and a very successful woman is a very hardworking woman.
The great one I can remember is the one my father gave to me to study hard. Actually, he was on his, I can say, maybe a deathbed. He was so ill. He had a stroke and he was so helpless. He couldn't do anything for me. That was the last day I even saw him. It was like, my son, study hard.
Is from my father. He has always told me that I shouldn't be afraid to learn new things and to take up new challenges, because he said that you're only afraid to take up new challenges when you haven't tried it.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. A Sudanese human rights activist is expressing concern over what she calls increased cases of human trafficking in the country over the past few months. Lubna Abdulrahman, who runs a non-profit in Khartoum, says hundreds of Ethiopians and Eritreans have been smuggled into Sudan and Libya with the intention of crossing the Mediterranean Sea into Europe in search of a better life. For VOA News, Michael Atit reports from Khartoum.
Activist Lubna Abdulrahman says the growing human smuggling and trafficking activities in Sudan in recent months are alarming due to weak institutions in the country. Abdulrahman says her office has documented dozens of cases of human smuggling into Sudan from neighboring countries, with the majority of the cases involving women and children. She says some of the victims of such activities end up in Khartoum as street beggars or engage in illegal drugs and commercial sex for survival.
Some of them, they come from Ethiopia or from Eritrea or from South Sudan. They come seeking for better life in Sudan. Unfortunately, the majority, 90%, are women and kids. And the other part, they come from Central Africa. Unfortunately, the bylaw of Sudan, they are very weak and fragile. This is make us very stressed.
Abdulrahman blames the deteriorating economic situation, porous borders, and a lack of enforcement of laws as contributing factors to the rise in human trafficking. Abdulrahman urges the Sudanese transitional government to strengthen law enforcement agencies, which she says should tackle what she calls strange phenomena in Sudanese society. She says some Sudanese young people, who seems to be frustrated with the living conditions in Sudan, have also fallen victim to human trafficking. Abdulrahman says hundreds of youth struggle to make their way into Europe through a challenging road via Libya and the Mediterranean Sea.
Some police officers, they are very active, like RFS, Da'am al-Sari'. They are very active now in Libya's area. They capture them. When they found, for example, if they capture a one or two cars, between 100, they have 10% are Sudanese.
Thousands of illegal immigrants, mostly Africans, choose to cross the Mediterranean Sea towards Europe from Libya, as the country has been mired in insecurity and chaos ever since the fall of former leader Muammar Gaddafi in 2011. Last year, the U.S. Department of State released a report saying the lack of institutional capacity, as well as lack of Libyan law enforcement, custom and military personnel, especially along the borders, hindered authorities' effort to combat human trafficking crimes. Libyan law criminalized some types of sexual trafficking, but did not criminalize labor trafficking. Abdulrahman says many organized groups in Sudan and neighboring countries are involved in human trafficking due to economic hardship in the region.
Human is human, no matter what, no matter race of the color, white or black. We have to work collaboratively together. There is a sensitiveness of the human trafficking. I need also the needs to be aware and first thing, afraid from God. Because if you don't have a heart for pity of sense of human, you cannot fight this human trafficking.
General Awadanil Dahia, a retired Sudanese police officer who has been in charge of the illegal migration department in Sudan for years, says many young Africans leaving their countries due to various internal factors, including insecurity and a lack of jobs. Dahia agrees that there is a need to empower the police and security forces in order to eradicate illegal migration in the country.
Some of them are also based on the ambition of the youth, because they want to see something better than what they are seeing at home, and if they are not getting actually the easy way actually to go, they will try the other way.
According to a report by the International Organization for Migration released in October 2018, there are more than 600,000 illegal migrants in Libya. In December 2019, authorities in Libya deported 140 illegal migrants to Sudan and Chad who were trying to cross the Mediterranean Sea to Europe. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum.
The World Health Organization says many African countries have yet to vaccinate 1% of their population against COVID-19 as the outbreak intensifies across the continent. This while wealthier countries who have immunized their most vulnerable citizens stockpile jabs to prepare for the possibility of a third round of vaccinations. The World Health Organization says Africa simply doesn't have the means to buy sufficient COVID-19 shots fast enough, and many thousands of lives are being lost because of this so-called vaccine iniquity. For VOA News, Darren Taylor reports from Johannesburg.
The epidemiologist in charge of South Africa's scientific response to the pandemic, Barry Shoub, says there are good reasons to give a third vaccine dose to people with weaker immune systems.
So this would be people with undercurrent illnesses or people on various treatments for cancer, for example, illnesses such as HIV and so on, where they're not responding as well to the normal two doses of Pfizer, for example. So a booster dose is being considered to actually again stimulate the immune system to get an immune response.
But like the WHO, many scientists believe it's in the world's best interests to make sure all vulnerable people around the globe have received at least one jab before any move is made toward third shots. They say it may be morally questionable for richer countries to buy millions of doses, while poorer regions such as Africa struggle for supplies. But such stockpiling has a scientific basis.
These are excellent vaccines, let's make no mistake about it. They've radically reduced severe disease, which really is the main aim at this stage of vaccination. So they're very good vaccines. But on the other hand, they're not as good as, for example, measles vaccine is one example, or polio, or any of those vaccines, which give very long-lasting, sometimes even lifelong immunity.
Shoub says it's impossible to say how long the available vaccines will protect against serious COVID-19.
But eventually we feel that that immunity is going to decay. Now, at this stage, it's too early to know how frequently we're going to need boosters in healthy individuals. It may be annually, maybe every 2 years, every 5 years. We don't know at this stage. I think we can be pretty confident that we will need boosters at a future time.
He says again, wealthier nations are buying all the different vaccines available based on current scientific knowledge.
There has been some evidence of some mixing of vaccines, which does have an advantage. Now, whether it's going to be that or whether the vaccines will need to be tweaked, I think they will need to be tweaked. Remember, we're only now in our first generation of vaccines. There will be improvements of vaccines as the science of vaccines develops.
Health activists say these improvements will result in richer countries dumping their original vaccines on Africa in the future. Shoup says the world's also going to need a lot more different vaccines because COVID-19's constantly mutating and throwing up new variants, making it unlikely for populations to ever achieve so-called herd immunity.
These variants occur in individuals who don't respond that well and where the virus continues to multiply. And as the virus multiplies, it's got more chance of being selected to escape the immunity. So it's not going to be that the population's immune. That's really the way that we have to deal with the virus, to stop it multiplying in individuals and to get as many people immunized as quickly as possible. That's really the aim.
Right now, says the WHO, that's far from being achieved in Africa, where life-saving vaccines remain rare. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Still on COVID, China's Wuhan City will test all of its 12 million residents for the coronavirus, an official said on Tuesday, after the place where the virus emerged in the late 2019 confirmed its first domestic cases of the highly transmissible Delta variant. Reuters' Maha Al-Badrawi has more.
Wuhan had reported no local coronavirus cases since May 2020, but on Monday, authorities confirmed three new cases of the Delta variant. The vice director of Hubei's Provincial Disease Control Center says these were linked to infections found in Huaiyan City in Jiangsu province. The outbreak in Jiangsu is believed to have begun in the provincial capital of Nanjing, with the Delta variant most likely introduced on a flight from Russia, according to officials. Since then, numerous cities in southern China and a few in the north, including Beijing, have reported infections. But it was not immediately clear if all of these cases were of the Delta variant or if they were all linked to Nanjing, as some authorities have not disclosed conclusive results of their virus tracing efforts. The Delta variant poses new risks for the world's second biggest economy as it spreads from the coast to inland cities. Authorities in numerous cities have launched mass testing to identify and isolate carriers.
That's all we prepared for you this Wednesday. Let's know what you think about this show. Our WhatsApp number is +12026308011. We now leave you with Gordon Kong singing about Sudan. Listening to Gordon Kong and his song Sudan. I'm John Tanza. Thanks for allowing us into your homes, phones, and vehicles. Remember to always wash your hands with soap, practice social distancing, and wear a mask when you're in public places to protect you and others from getting COVID-19. Do not escape from COVID-19 quarantine centers because there's no cure for coronavirus. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.